an economic fiber of the city, we've invited the university's new president to share his vision with us of education, campus life, university politics, and the relationship of the university to the community. Sheldon Hackney came to Philadelphia from New Orleans, where he served as the president for 5 years of Tulane University. Prior to that, he was a provost at Princeton University. He completed his own undergraduate education at Vanderbilt, received his doctorate from Yale. He's an historian who specialized in the history of the American South, and he's been particularly interested in the history of the civil rights movement in America, and he teaches a course on that subject. He'll be living with his wife, Lucy Hackney, who's a lawyer on the university campus. Welcome to Fresh Air, Sheldon Hackney, and thank you for taking some time out of your busy schedule to join us today.
Great to be here.
How do you scope out a university when you're new to the city and new to the university?
It's a complicated process, but it's one that I have gone through before, and I've lived in universities for some time. I'm a denizen of universities, so it's something I enjoy. I talk to people, basically. I talk to students. I've spent a good bit of the spring talking to as many faculty and students as I could get hold of in various ways. That is the chief means. You can read catalogs and formal documents. Those help. But I would rather know what people feel about the institution, particularly how students enjoy their experience, what problems they see, what faculty think are the problems of the future, and what they're really engaged in. Penn is a special place, so it's been very interesting to get to know it.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about what you've learned through that informal survey?
Sure. I can talk about Penn forever and ever. You'll have to cut me off. The other places I have been are similar to Penn in that they are high-quality private institutions, as Penn is, but they are different in that they're much smaller. That is, Princeton and Tulane were both smaller, and I did my graduate work at Yale, which is a bit smaller. And they are also much less urban and much less diverse than Penn. The most striking thing about Penn when you come on the campus is a feeling of energy and a feeling of diversity, heterogeneity that's there. And that's not so much true of the other places I've been. So I noticed that right away. I treasure it. I think it's something that Penn needs to build on very much and does build on. It is also engaged in various ways at the forefront of the creation of new knowledge. It has Nobel laureates around, programs that are attracting outside support for research. There's a good bit of interaction among different kinds of programs, which I think Penn does perhaps better than similar universities elsewhere. That is, there's more interdisciplinary work, more contact between scholars in the medical school, for instance, and scholars in the Faculty of Arts and Science or the dental school. All of the professional schools are very high quality and devoted to basic research as well as to professional education, which I think is a special flavor.
One of the most obvious functions of the university is to provide a place for higher education, but everyone who's gone to college will tell you lots of stories about the other things that they learned at the university and the other things that university life did in developing their personality. What do you see as the functions of the university and of university life?
Universities are peculiar places because they have several different missions and not just one. If you're a business corporation, the purpose is to make a profit through producing certain services or products. It's much more difficult to figure out what a particular school or university is about. The faculty will give you one answer, the students will give you another answer, the alumni have a different feeling about what it ought to be doing, and they're all right. So it really is a place that tries to do several different things at once. Maybe three of them are sufficient to illustrate this. The university is devoted to creating new knowledge, that is, to research and to advancing humankind by discovering new truths, new relationships, new knowledge about the world around us, and so on. And we do that, I think, very well. It's also devoted to education, to passing on that knowledge and to passing on the techniques of creating new knowledge to neophytes in the profession or in the academic enterprise, to students, that is. And it is also a place where, whether we like it or not, young people grow up. We don't have only young people as students, but we do have a traditional aged student population. And they are in residence. They are going through a very delicate time of their lives when they're discovering who they are and what they want to be, what the possibilities are, trying out new roles, discovering new fields. And that's very important. I think most educators think that what happens outside the classroom is just as important as what happens inside. One of the challenges of the next few years at Penn, in particular, I think, is to think carefully about what happens outside and to try to make sure that that is a healthy, rewarding, and growing experience for the students.
Well, we'll get back to that in a minute. What are some of the most memorable experiences of your undergraduate years?
I have some of the same experiences most people have having too much to drink on occasion, and but also sitting up all night talking with friends about what the meaning of life is, and does God exist, and what do you do next, and is History 101 worth it, and problems of immense scope and variety. I got interested in history in college for the first time, and determined by the time I was at the end of my undergraduate career, I had figured out that I wanted to be a historian. So I got both a vocational breakthrough and also 4 very interesting years of getting to know other people and trying to figure out what life was all about.
So that aspect of things was obviously important for you when you were in college. And you said at Penn that you'd like to see what happens outside of the classroom, more importance put on that. What do you mean, and how can that be done?
Well, Penn traditionally has been a marvelous place. It's an urban institution in the typical tradition of urban institutions where people come and are exposed to marvelous intellectual experiences. It has probably traditionally spent less time thinking about the residential setting than a small college, than Haverford or Dartmouth or what have you. And I think that we could benefit from some of the lessons of the smaller colleges in designing residential experiences that are more fulfilling. We have made a big start already, that my predecessors have made a big start, in providing for about a quarter of the undergraduate student population what we call residential house, college house situations, where faculty live in the dormitories and are involved with students in extracurricular activities. And students can control those activities, and they're student-run, but also faculty are in close concert with them. That's healthy, I think, being for students, college students, to come into contact with all different sorts of adults is good. And for them to live closely together in a common enterprise for a period of time is very good. So it's more than a dormitory existence. It is a community that they create, and that I think is important.
Is co-ed dormitories still an issue on campus?
Not that I know of. All of our dormitories are co-ed now. That was not true at Tulane, but it is true here, and I think that's healthy.
I'm sure a lot of the Penn students live in the community around Penn in University City in West Philadelphia.
That's right. About half the students live on the campus in dormitories or university-run facilities, and about half off. Most of those who live off campus live in West Philadelphia.
That's just one of the ways that students in the university inevitably interacts with the community around it. But what do you think the relationship should be between a university like Penn and the neighborhood that it's in?
Needs to be a close relationship. We have an obvious interest in the character of the community around us, our immediate neighborhood in particular, but also the health of the city more broadly. One might think that a university ought to be more like an ivory tower. The resources that we get come to us because of donors being interested in education or research. Students pay a tuition to get a particular experience at Penn. None of that money comes to us specifically for helping the city or helping the neighborhood. So we have to stop and think very carefully about why we should divert some of those funds that come to us for education and research into doing something else. But I think we have a real need to do so. Some of it is self-interest. A lot of it is self-interest because we would like to live as a university in a community that is stimulating and supporting, where there are services, where there are good human relationships, so our students can live in a comfortable neighborhood, get along with their neighbors. So we, I think, need to be doing much more than we've done in the past in being a good neighbor. Though I think we have been a good neighbor.
I think one of the problems that a school like Penn has, being an expensive and Ivy League school located in in inner city areas that a lot of people in the neighborhood couldn't ever afford the tuition at the university and could feel like extremely priced out and left out, and you know, possibly that can create negative attitudes towards the university.
Yeah, there are town gown problems and tensions at most places. Particularly at a high quality school that is invited. People look at us as elite and aloof, apart from the city, and we want to be less aloof. We do, though, share our facilities in various ways with the neighborhood. There are recreational programs where neighborhood young people come and enjoy it. Our students are very much involved in several of those. We're also the largest private employer in the five-county area, so we have a citizenship role to play there. Our wage taxes and our real estate taxes are a real part of the economy of the city. We can do a good bit, and we do a good bit already. We can do more in the way of sharing the things that go on the campus with the city. The Annenberg Center is a good example of that, where there's already a heavy involvement of the community in the work of the university, in the theater there. We would like to do a bit more in helping train public sector managers in the city, for instance. We've been talking with the city administration about that. They're very receptive, so I think we'll be doing more of that in the future.
Penn is an Ivy League school. What does it mean to you to be an Ivy League university?
Yeah, that's strange. The Ivy League started before I was around, basically, but in the early 50s it was primarily formed as an athletic conference originally. But it's far more than that now, a whole set of relationships and understandings about admission standards and financial aid standards and so forth go on. Ivy League, in the popular parlance, I suppose, means private and selective. And
expensive and hard to get into.
That's right. That's right.
But prestigious.
Yes. And I don't think that's all bad. In fact, I think that's good. One of the happy things that has happened over the last generation is that even though we're very selective and very hard to get into and very expensive, we have made it possible up to this point for anyone, no matter what their financial background or racial background or sex, to be admitted and to enjoy the education there. The test that we would like to apply is, can the student do the work? Can he or she benefit from the sort of education that's provided here, which is fairly competitive and high-pressured? And if the answer to those questions is yes, then the student can come, and we will provide the financial aid to make it possible. That is threatened now, however, by what is going on in Washington, and that's the chief worry that I have at the moment, is whether we're going to be able to find the resources, the money, to fill in the student aid programs that are being abandoned or diminished by the Reagan administration and Congress. I understand why they're doing what they're doing, but it's very hard. It's going to make education much less accessible to the young people of the country.
Well, another thing that's happening is that there seems, I think, to be less people of college age than there was a few years ago. As that baby boom swell, leaves the college age, there's less people of college age around. Is that affecting the number of people who apply to the colleges? Are colleges getting more competitive with one another?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. It has not affected Penn yet. In fact, at Penn, we're getting more applicants and better applicants over the last three years than before. We're doing things better. That's why. And we are getting six applications for every position we have in the undergraduate programs. So I think we're not going to be affected. Someone is going to be affected. And I guess every college president says it's not going to be my institution, and someone is going to be mistaken, because those figures are real. There are fewer 18 to 21-year-olds. The numbers of 18 to 21-year-olds is going to decline precipitously in the next few years, particularly after 1984. And that's bound to have an effect. And it will mean that there is more competition among institutions, and that's already showing up. Schools are competing for students in a much more direct way than before, turning to advertising, and some are turning to gimmicks, which I think are not really very good, to attract students. I hope we're able to police that in such a way as not to let it get out of hand. But that's a danger.
Do you think that there needs to be special programs in order to ensure that minorities are given fair consideration, working from perhaps a disadvantaged vantage point in applying to a school like Penn?
Sure. We do in various ways already do that in financial aid, and we have some special recruitment efforts to make sure that we bring to the attention of qualified minority students the fact that Penn exists and it is accessible to them. It is accessible now anyway, and I hope it will remain that way. That's justified, and the reason it's justified is that one of our missions, back to this multiple mission thing, is to provide people for leadership positions in the future, people with good educations. Every sector of the society needs those leaders, those well-prepared people, and we have an obligation to provide a good part of that training and education for every sector. So I think we need to reach out and make sure that they a fair number come to Penn. We also have a selfish interest in it because the mix of students on campus is a real part of the educational experience. If it's a homogeneous place, I think that's a less good sort of education for the students who are there. We live in a very diverse world. Students might as well start getting used to that when they're and enjoying it while they're in college and learning from it. The dormitory life itself would be much less interesting unless the person living next door is somehow different from a different part of the country or from a foreign country. We have a large foreign student population. So I think we have selfish interests and also community responsibility to reach out a bit.
I've heard some people say that, you know, of the Ivy League schools, like Penn is the one that you go to if you didn't get in, if you didn't get admitted by the others.
Ah, yes, that haunts us.
Is that one of the things you were told when you came here?
Yes, and there's a certain defensiveness on the part of some Penn students and some Penn faculty about that. It may have been true at one point. I think it's much less true these days. We do compete with Ivy League schools for students, and I think we do for students who are accepted to several Ivy League schools, including Penn, we compete very well. We're not yet beating everybody in the league for those students, but we're quite competitive and attracting more and more overlapped students.
You mentioned budget cutbacks before as being something that you figure is going to have an adverse effect on Penn and on other colleges and universities. Do you see yourself as being in a position to lobby or to apply pressure, be an advocate? I don't know what kind of pressure groups have been forming on the part of educators.
We lobby in various ways. That's not a good word since we're not supposed to do that. We make our case,
yes,
in
sir.
Washington and Harrisburg.
Thank you.
In various ways. We also work through various educational associations, the American Council on Education, the American Association of Universities. There's a group of private institutions called the Consortium on the Financing of Higher Education works a good bit in Washington. So we work through those groups. I've also been to Washington to meet the Pennsylvania delegation and to talk to them about our particular situation and about higher education in general. I've been to Harrisburg a couple of times. I've talked to the governor. We try to be as forceful as we can. In the current discussions in Congress, I think higher education has had an effect, and there are a number of friends of higher education in Congress who've so far mitigated the effect of the Stockman budget, in a good way, I think.
Let me reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. I'm speaking with Sheldon Hackney, who's the new president of the University of Pennsylvania. What's your typical day like?
Busy. I'm not an early riser, so I get to the office whenever things are supposed to start there, but I spend most of my day talking to people, and it goes straight through, which is a problem I've got, because there's less time available for reading mail and writing letters and trying to get things done that come out of these conversations than I would like. But that's my own problem. I'll have to wrestle with that. And I typically will have something to do in the evening that's connected with the job in one way or another. Mm-hmm. So on a typical day, I will see maybe a dozen individuals in individual conversations when school is in session this past spring, I made on the average of one or two talks before groups a day, and it was just very hectic.
How do you see your role on the campus? I mean, in part, you have to set the educational tone and be the kind of academic leader of the university, but you also have fiscal accountability to shoulder also. So how do you see your role?
I'm responsible for everything, so I try to be the person where the fiscal responsibility and the educational mission come together. Fortunately, there are a lot of other people there who are quite capable. One of my greatest responsibilities is to make sure that I have the right people in the right spots, the right officers, recruiting the provost, naming the vice presidents, supporting them, getting them to work together is a big part of my responsibility. The president also is the chief spokesman for the institution outside the institution, not only to the trustees, which is a peculiar responsibility of mine, but to various audiences outside. I take that seriously. I think I am also the officer of the university who ought to lead the planning effort, who ought to think about the future, get other people to think about the future of the university and to plan.
How important is balancing the books at the university?
Crucial. The trustees have made it necessary. They've created a mandate that we will run with a balanced budget each year, so that there's no if, and, or but about that.
What are the sacrifices you have to make to do that?
We squeeze very hard. We had a harder time this past budget year putting together the budget for 1981-82 than in recent years. And we tend to squeeze where it's easiest to squeeze. It's very tempting to defer maintenance on buildings or to hold down salaries. You can only do a certain amount of that without beginning to hurt the institution. Made some difficult decisions about closing out positions, not many individuals, but empty positions, which would have been filled if we didn't close them down. So we go without services. We live less well, if you will, with fewer support staff. We did not hurt any of the educational programs, did not cut the faculty. We were able to provide faculty increases in salary. If you look around the Well, I think this is a national problem that equipment, particularly scientific equipment and plant buildings, have suffered in the last 10 years because of the financial problems of higher education. I hope that can be reversed, but I'm not very sanguine because we're in for another 10 years of really tough times.
There's been a program of landscaping and just trying to improve the way the campus looks.
Oh, yeah.
And is designed. Is there more to go on that? Will you be continuing that program?
Yeah, that's a very interesting thing. Penn has now one of the loveliest urban campuses in the country, if not the nicest. I am thrilled with that. I understand that when the decision was made by Martin Meyerson and who's my predecessor, and others on the university campus several years ago to spend the money to re-landscape and beautify the campus, there was a good bit of opposition. The faculty and students said, that's not a good thing to do with that money. We could put it into scholarships or put it into salaries, and it would be much better spent. Nobody says that now. The people really enjoy being in a beautiful environment. It helps you be more productive. It makes you feel better about the place, makes you feel better about yourself. So we will be doing some more of that. It's also one way of contributing to the educational mission. The nice thing about the campus is not only that it has green grass that's inviting, people lie on it or throw frisbees on it, but there are various gathering points on the campus, benches and plazas, patios. Those things bring people together to talk.
Sure, places to have conversations about what am I here for and whether God exists and all the things you were talking
about before.
Well, you've actually decided to live on campus, and I think it's an interesting decision. A lot of people like to get away from their jobs and from the people who they're professionally associated with, and you're going to be living right in the middle of it. Why did you choose that?
I may change my mind after I've been there for a while, but I don't think so. The next few years for Penn are years of building a much more intense community itself. There are more faculty moving into West Philadelphia now, living around the campus. We We have, compared to 1940, there are many more students living on the campus in residence or living right near the campus. It has changed character as an institution in the last 30 or 40 years. And I think it's time now for that to be symbolized by the chief executive officer living in the midst of this residential community. So I thought it was a good thing to do. Also, it's much more convenient for me. I can walk to the office in 2 minutes. I can have people to my house for lunch or dinner very easily, or for a meeting during the middle of the day or late in the afternoon. It's just very nice. If I can convince the Sigma News across the street or to be quiet, I will enjoy it, I think.
If it was me, I'd probably worry about not being able to get away from it all.
Well, that it's a wearing job, that's true, and I will have to find ways to get away and to think. Just as an individual, I think most people may be this way, but I feel the need to have time to reflect and to think about what I'm doing. And that's harder to do when you're engaged 16 hours a day with people.
Yeah, I think that's true. Let's talk a little bit about student representation. I know when I was in college, this was a really big issue, and I'm not sure to what extent this is an issue that's still like hotly debated on campus.
It's been resolved.
It's all finished now.
Yeah.
What's your opinion on how students should be, if at all, represented on academic committees, and how much input they should have, and the requirements for graduation, and what courses incoming students should be required to take?
Students need to be involved in the decision-making process because the decisions are better if they're involved. The level of their involvement should differ according to the degree. There's some things that students know a lot about and which affect them fundamentally, and they ought to be more involved in those things. Student life questions, for instance, ought to be heavily impacted, that's a terrible word, with student opinion. That is, if there are committees, as there are, on student life questions, they ought to be dominated by students, I think, as well as by the staff people who are in that area. There are other things which affect students, certainly, but about which students know less. Tenure decisions, appointment decisions of faculty, for instance. Well, student opinion is useful there, and it ought to be tapped in some way. But I don't think students ought to have the predominant say. Faculty can judge their colleagues much better than students can, though they ought to make those judgments in the light of how students respond to various faculty members.
I remember one of the arguments being that students are the ones who have to live with the education and with the people who are teaching. But the other side of so they should have input. But the other side of that argument is, yeah, but they're gone in a few years, whereas everybody else at the university remains, and the university continues as the students keep getting recycled.
Yeah, that's true. Faculty will, in particular, make that argument that the typical faculty member is there for 40 years, the student is there for 4.
Yeah, well, what do you think of the tenure system? You know, I think that's an idea that's being maybe a little reevaluated now.
Yeah.
Whether someone should have that lifetime tenure at a university.
Yeah. At a place like Penn, it does not really impose any great problem if you make the appointment decisions and the tenure decisions themselves very carefully, as we do, and have very tough standards. It is a question that is being opened at various places around the country, and people are thinking about short-term contracts or long-term contracts so that every 5 years or 10 years a faculty member is reviewed by his colleagues. That's not necessary at Penn or first-level institutions, but it might be something to think about at others. I believe in tenure because I still think it's necessary to protect academic freedom, there are even selfish reasons for that. If we didn't have tenure, administrators would spend an awful lot of time explaining to people why we're not firing Joe Smith. Now we can simply say, well, we can't do that. There's a contractual relationship. But that's a cop-out, basically. There is a great temptation in times of crisis when a faculty member has become very controversial to fire him or do something else to hurt his employment. And I think that's bad in the long run. And the one strong protection against that is the tenure system. And that is still true.
This is a time when it's getting perhaps a little difficult for outspoken people to be freely outspoken. And you mentioned the importance of academic freedom. How do you protect academic freedom and protect the right of the faculty members at a university to express themselves freely?
The tenure system does that, but it is probably not necessary at a place with a strong board of trustees that believe in academic freedom. That would be true at the University of Pennsylvania, certainly. There is a very strong ethos in higher education in general about academic freedom, in support of it. It is violated still every year. There are cases of people being denied jobs or fired from jobs because of their ideological commitments or because of something they've said in public rather than something they've done that's untoward. So the strong ethos doesn't protect against that, but it probably does. I mean, it is the first line of defense. If everyone understands that the heart of a university is the free exchange of ideas and that any idea, no matter how horrendous, ought to be allowed so it can be examined, then I think the situation is very healthy.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is the importance now of things like women's studies and black studies, ideas which, programs which got their start about a decade ago, and some universities have gotten stronger and other universities have kind of petered out. Mm-hmm. I believe Penn has both a women's studies and
That's
a
right.
black studies program.
Yeah.
What do you think is their relevance now?
Both are still relevant. They're very legitimate subjects. The novelty is that they draw upon different disciplines. They're not traditional in the sense of a history department or an English department. But we have other departments, rather traditional, that are not disciplines but are oriented toward a subject. We have a Middle Eastern studies program, for instance, or Latin American studies program, in which economists and historians and archaeologists and anthropologists all cooperate. So that bringing together a set of people who are bound together not by a commitment to a discipline, but by a commitment to an interest in a subject, is not new in academic life. Black studies and women's studies is just a recent example of that. So if it's done rigorously, and if the people involved are very serious about exploring ideas and extending the area of knowledge in those areas, I see nothing at all wrong with it. The institution has to make some decisions about where it wants to put its resources, and it costs money to do new things. So that's the limitation.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to ask whether you're doing it well.
How do you evaluate that?
You look at the teaching and the scholarship of the people involved, basically, and the response of the students, clearly.
Every period of time has its unique problems and its unique set of colors also, just its unique patterns and trends. And you've been on universities teaching, acting as provost president for a number of years now, and you've
Yes.
seen a number of different political and social cultural trends happen. What do you think of the student protests on the campus about a decade ago? I think you were at Princeton.
I was at Princeton then.
And I'm sure you were paying close attention to what was happening all around the country and how different university
yeah.
provosts and presidents were handling it.
Yeah, and it was handled differently at different places.
Yeah.
I do not want to go back to the 60s. Those were turbulent times that were very upsetting in a way, but it was not all bad. Universities, it was a revolutionary period in a good sense of the word. That is, universities had to think very carefully about what they were and about how they were organized, and they did change at that time. And a lot of those changes were good. There were some curriculum changes that probably went too far and have been rolled back since then and rethought. But a lot of basic organizational changes were healthy and were good. The worst part of that period is that a number of young people really were lost in a way. They got so involved in their commitment to outside causes and either to the anti-war movement or to the civil rights movement or to self-exploration through drugs or some other sort of self-actualization, that they lost sight of what their goal in life should be. Some of those young folks are still drifting around, I think, very unhappy, and still they haven't found themselves. That's a peculiarity of the 1960s, and it's a great cost that generation of young people has paid. I don't like that, but some of the other aspects of the decade were more positive.
Uh-huh. Is that kind of drifting an argument for maintaining kind of firm sense of requirements, like academic requirements and values and standards, even when there's a lot of questioning and turmoil happening?
I guess so. What you're really suggesting is that the that adults in universities ought to behave like adults, even if the students are saying you're wrong.
Well, I'm kind of wondering what you think, because I remember it was getting back to when I was in college that part of the university, part of the faculty seemed to be really wishing that they were students and were kind of going through the turmoil with the students and were out demonstrating instead of being in classes. And many of the faculty were out demonstrating instead of being in classes.
Yes.
But others felt firmly committed to maintaining academic life in spite of what was going on in the outside world, and that relevance was, in fact, not the key issue in universities. So reflecting on that, like, if it all happened again, what do you think you'd think? Not that you can say, right?
Yeah, it would be hard. I feel very ambivalent now because I feel torn in both directions. The issues that were forced upon students and faculty members then were real issues. And the war was a real thing, and it was bad. One had to come to terms with that some way. Someone, though, needed to keep the institution's eye on the long-term goal. That was done very well at some places. Standards were not let down. The institution was not torn apart, yet people were allowed to express and explore their own feelings about the social issues around them. I don't think that's going to, my own prediction is that's not going to happen again anytime soon, even though we may be in for a decade of a good bit of social friction and conflict because of inflation and the withdrawal symptoms from inflation. And this may, I may be totally wrong about this, my own theory is that for a real social movement to get going, there needs to be some receptive leadership, oddly enough. For radicals to really cut loose and get a lot of resonance and support from the society, the national leadership has to be receptive or inviting somehow. Or people have to believe that if they kick up enough fuss, the national leadership is going to respond sympathetically. And I don't think that exists now, so I don't think it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to reintroduce you for our listeners just joining in. Speaking with Sheldon Hackney, the new president of the University of Pennsylvania, I know you spend a lot of time speaking with students. So from your conversations, what do you think are some of the personal or more societal issues that students lose sleep over now?
They lose more sleep maybe over personal issues now, but there are still a good many students who have social commitments as well and who are worried about environmental issues and the other social issues of the day. Young women are very worried about still the choices that they are going to have to make. This is career or family, or how do you combine them both? Do you be a superwoman? Is that possible? If not, what choice do you make? Young men are wrestling with the obverse of the same set of issues: is how do I find intimacy and support and pursue my career in the same way. So there, all those personal issues are still there, and more so, one finds students being very interested in the environment and, I guess, the international situation.
What are the things that men, but not women, will be wrestling with, I think, now is whether or not to register. And
That's right.
Do you see the university as having any role there in helping men come to terms with that question?
Not through the curriculum, but certainly on the campus, it is something that will be discussed. And in various informal ways, faculty and others in the university community ought to help students think about those issues in a rational, reasonable way and come to their own decisions.
I'd like to get briefly to a decision that you made that made headlines in the Philadelphia newspapers, and that was your firing of the head of the university museum. And if you could share with us both the reasons for that and what it was like for you having this very intense press coverage so new in so early yeah. on in your reign. I wonder if there's a honeymoon period for
there was no honeymoon for me.
University presidents.
No, but yeah, we have a very active student newspaper, so they have already indoctrinated me to my role as a scapegoat. I can't talk about that much, actually. We have an agreement, an amicable agreement with the former director of the museum that I would like to honor. He is a marvelous person, actually, and I don't want to say anything to indicate otherwise. But the museum is a marvelous treasure for the university and for the city, and it is an international treasure as well. So I was trying to get the university and the museum in a position to fulfill its mission a bit more. And I think we'll be on the way. Things have calmed down a bit. I was a bit surprised, I guess, at finding things like that on the front page of the local paper. I would have thought other issues would have been as important for the citizens of Philadelphia. But
okay, so no honeymoon period there. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about your academic life. We've spoken about your role as president of the University of Pennsylvania, but you have another role even within Penn, and that is as a teacher and as a historian. Your area of specialization has been the history of the American South, and I know you're particularly interested in the history of the Civil Rights Movement, and I wonder what has made that your special interest.
I got interested in history originally the way a lot of people get interested in any intellectual area, as a way of finding out more about myself, oddly enough. I was born and raised in the South in Alabama and grew up thinking that probably had a lot to do with why I am like I am. And I actually enjoyed history and reading history, so I thought that was, I guess subconsciously, and this is not a conscious thing, I just thought that I would know much more about myself, where I came from, what my cultural roots and values were, if I studied it rigorously. And it's a way of explaining myself to myself. So I got involved in history in that way, and then grew from there to being really interested in the professional discovery of history and the writing of it. And I it's a mixture of sort of personal moral commitments and intellectual interest and professional commitments. Civil rights movement is interesting because I have always been interested in the race relations in the South. One of the first papers I did as an undergraduate in college was about race relations in the South. This was in the early 50s, before it was really a hot topic of conversation. And I have been interested ever since. But I have not done a lot of scholarship on that. I did a good bit of work on the late 19th century on an agrarian reform movement called populism, and from that I got interested in reform movements and radical movements in general. What makes them go? What are the internal dynamics? Then it occurred to me, and I was at the same time, of course, living through the civil rights movement and being very interested in it as an observer reading the newspapers, and it occurred to me that a lot of the observations that I was able to make about populism in the 1890s and other radical movements, revolutionary movements in the 19th century, were also true if you looked at civil rights organizations and the civil rights movement in general. So I began to get interested in the civil rights movement, not only as a moral commitment, if you will, but as an example of how a protest movement gets started and operates and dies.
You grew up in Alabama, and that's a state that has a reputation for being one of the most racist states in the country. I don't know how much time how much, if at all, you return back to your home state, but to what extent is racism still there in a state like Alabama, or how much has it changed? Because I don't pay many visits to the South, but I certainly hear a lot about the New South and how much it's changed.
You're going to draw out my professional Southernism now. There is racism in the South, but there's racism in Philadelphia, and one of the first responses that you'll hear from even liberal Southerners is that the South is different, but not in moral sin, but in the shape of that, indeed. one of the old saws is that Southern whites and I can't repeat it right now. I can only even remember it in fact, but that in the South, blacks and whites are physically closer, yet psychologically more distant. That is, whites hate blacks, but are very close to them. In the North, they're not close to them, but there is an abstract affinity between the races. That may or may not be true, but I find is as much racism in the North as in the South. The South has been through, though, a fundamental social revolution since the 1960s, since 1960, since really the Montgomery bus boycott in 1956. There simply is no way to describe it. In urban centers in the South, there is a degree of interaction between blacks and whites now in public places, in restaurants, in public life, that was unthinkable, just utterly unthinkable 20 years ago or 15 years ago. And though it's not, the situation is not as it should be, as the saying goes, it's sure a whole lot better than it used to be.
How connected do you think that the generation that grew up during or after the beginnings of the civil rights movement feel to the official segregation that took place before that? Because it was, for many young people, their parents who upheld that segregation, and if they're growing up in an atmosphere where that is no longer condoned and no longer practiced, they might be growing up with a different consciousness, but have to cope with how recent that segregation mm-hmm. was and how their friends and families were behind it.
That's an interesting question. I don't think most Southerners face that, basically. The change has been very rapid, but they don't, young people don't sit around and they don't ask the question, where were my parents in 1956 when this was going on, or in 1963 or 64 and during the Mississippi Freedom Summer? That's a real question to ask, but I don't. Maybe it's because it's so painful to have to explore that. I went through a lot of painful conversations with my own family, for whom I have great love and understanding. We differed over these issues about racial segregation, but I never lost contact with them. But it is still very painful to have to differ about such a fundamental question.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we Southerners may just avoid that and go right on.
Yeah.
In the rural areas of the South, it has not changed quite that much, and that's where the real problem is.
If I can just change the subject again.
Sure.
Hey, what are some of the films and books that have really had an important influence on you?
Well, in my professional life, the work of C. Vann Woodward has probably been the most fundamentally important to me. He is a historian of the South, has written a biography of Tom Watson, Agrarian Rebel, it was called, which Tom Watson was a politician from Georgia who was a central figure in the populist movement. And he also wrote a book called Origins in the New South, which was about the South in the late 19th century. And my work takes off from that a good bit. But beyond that and other historians, Eric Erickson's work, the psychoanalyst and psychologist, he's written Young Man Luther and the biography of Gandhi, but a book called Childhood and Society, which is a book about how the culture influences individual personality, was very influential in the way I think about the social bases of politics and how we're all shaped by our culture. There have been other books like that that have affected me.
Mm-hmm.
I like film very much, but I don't tend to think of it as having a fundamental influence on my direction I go.
I frequently think of academic life for a student as this being, much as you may complain when you're in school, as being a kind of oasis in your life where you can like devote yourself pretty fully to thinking things through, both on a personal basis and on a more academic basis, and that it also is associated with that part in your personal life where you're developing your adult personality and trying to figure out who you are there. And it's a place that offers a lot of freedom, in a way, to do that kind of growing and questioning, developing. But when you're a professional in the university campus, does it still offer that kind of freedom and constant provocation that it frequently does is when you're a student, because it's a profession and a job, and I don't know what that university life and atmosphere means to you.
I got involved in academic life maybe in a typical way, because I thought that it would provide a sort of bucolic, quiet, reflective existence that I wanted at that time while I thought through the deeper questions of the world. And I was rudely surprised when I got to graduate school and found out that it wasn't that way at all, and that if indeed if you wanted to have a secure job, you had to work very hard at teaching and scholarship. Then I got hooked by that, by the working hard at teaching and scholarship, and found that I enjoyed it. And that maybe doesn't happen to everybody, but to a large number of faculty, it does. Some they get socialized into the process, and they enjoy it. For faculty members and administrators, life at a university is quite hectic. If there is one thing we learned from the 1960s, it is that you can't, that it's part of the real world. It is not an ivory tower, that the issues that divide society will show up on the college campus. In fact, show up maybe in a more intense way. Our relationships with the Union of South Africa, for instance, are probably more deeply felt and discussed and are more deeply divisive on a university campus than anywhere else in America. Those issues are there, and light in just the day-to-day, the quotidian in existence is very hectic, busy, but I like it.
Okay, we only have about a minute or so left. Do you have any changes in mind for the university? It's probably really early ask you for a course of action or anything.
Yeah. Not really. We're just in the very beginning stages of a planning process. A big, great university like Penn is driven by the faculty, by and large. That is, the faculty interest in what they're doing, what they're teaching, and what they're learning is the basis for the educational program. That's not bad at all, because the faculty is extremely good. So my job is to discover what the strengths are of the faculty and tease out of them a coherent program for the university.
Sheldon Hackney, I want to thank you very much for spending this hour with us. It's been very interesting, and I thank you for taking time out of your schedule to visit with us.
I've enjoyed it. Anytime.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I've been speaking with Sheldon Hackney. He's the new president of the University of Pennsylvania. He assumed that position earlier this year, leaving his post of president of Tulane University in New Orleans, a position that he held for 5 years. It's 2 minutes to 5 o'clock, and we'll be joining National Public Radio for All Things Considered in a couple of minutes. But I'd just like to tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. At 2 o'clock, we'll be rebroadcasting an interview with trumpeter Nat Adderley. He will be performing in town Saturday evening, and since he'll be back in our city, we thought we'd replay that interview with him. And at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by R. Murray Schaefer, who is a composer, but also someone who studies sound environments. And we'll be talking about what you can learn by listening to an environment, about the culture of that place and the people who inhabit it, and basically the society and life there. And we'll be hearing some examples of tapes that he's made when he joins us tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. Oh, and at 3:30, Bill Van Wert, our film reviewer, will be reviewing Superman 2. So hope you can join us tomorrow afternoon. The technical director for today's show was Joyce Lieberman, and contributing today was Francis Davis. The production assistant for Fresh Air is Maeve McGoran. The associate producer is Danny Miller. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great evening. This is WUHY FM in Philadelphia, where listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Sanford Unger.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
This is Reggie Jackson. Don't turn off your water supply by turning on a hydrant. It wastes a million gallons a day. Join the team that's keeping New York wet.
New York City has a water crisis. Its antiquated system is breaking down, the pipes leak, and droughts will soon make things worse. Tonight on All Things Considered, the first in a series of reports on a nationwide water crisis.
And these stories in Poland, a short strike, a warning by employees of LOT, the state-controlled airline. The workers want to choose their own boss.
In Britain, continuing violence in Manchester, an angry debate today in the House of Commons.
In South Africa, criticism of the U.S. ambassador to that country.
Secretary of State Haig defends the administration's decision to support loan programs again to countries that once were considered human rights violators.
Hearings begin on Capitol Hill concerning the rights of Japanese Americans who were put into camps during World War II.
In Italy, the stock market shuts down and the lira continues to fall.
And a man in Arizona has somehow cornered the market on words. He's selling them, three words for $8.
That and more on All Things Considered. First, this news from Robert Covington.
A Senate subcommittee voted today to approve legislation defining life as beginning at conception. It's the first congressional step toward overturning the 1973 Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion. The bill, approved 3-2 by the Judiciary Subcommittee, gives unborn fetuses full rights under the Constitution. Critics say if such legislation becomes law, a woman who has an abortion would be subject to prosecution for murder. Further congressional action on the so-called Human Life Bill is not expected before next year. Opposition is mounting to the nomination of Arizona Judge Sandra D. O'Connor to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court. A coalition of conservative and anti-abortion groups said today she had a pro-abortion voting record and that they would oppose her nomination. Coalition spokesman Howard Phillips.
On the basis of Mrs. O'Connor's public record in favor of abortion, the conservative caucus plans to oppose her confirmation. Our opposition will take the form of briefing grassroots conservatives concerning Mrs. O'Connor's legislative record and urging them to seek withdrawal of the nomination by President Reagan, as well as Senate votes against confirmation should withdrawal not occur.
Phillips says an apparent cover-up prevented President Reagan from seeing the true voting record of O'Connor on abortion. The National Women's Political Caucus opened its annual convention today in Albuquerque, New Mexico. There was severe criticism of groups mounting a challenge to the O'Connor nomination, as we hear in this report from Diana Stauffer of member station KUNM.
Women's Caucus leader Iris Mitgang says an individual's personal beliefs are irrelevant to his or her qualifications as a judge, and she calls the moral majority's attack on Supreme Court nominee Sandra O'Connor offensive to the judicial process.
The issue that needs to be addressed in regard to a judge and the possibility for that person to serve the public well is their ability to apply and interpret the law in a neutral fashion regardless of their personal beliefs. So I think that the campaign that the moral majority is mounting is scurrilous.
Mitgang and other leaders of the women's rights movement are meeting in Albuquerque, New Mexico this week to plan strategies for electing feminists to public office. The women will also target for defeat certain state legislators around the country, particularly those who do not support the Equal Rights Amendment and abortion choice. The 55,000-member organization has also unveiled plans to raise $1 million war chest by the next general election. For National Public Radio, I'm Diana Stauffer in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
A federal grand jury has indicted